Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi everybody, so welcome to a double bill here on Wild Wild Podcast. I think this might be our first double bill, we're continuing a look at the films of Luigi Cozzi, and today I thought it would be fun to try and do both of his Hercules movies, and I'm really hoping that Rod can tell me what the plot was.
I think with a little help from notes, I can probably do that. Yes,
and try and piece it together.
Mm-hmm. At least with the first film. With the second film, we're not doing two films, Adrian. Let's say this up front: we're doing about one film and about a third of another. That's what we're doing.
That's true. These are fun, but. I should also say, as we're in December now, I will say Buon Natale to you, Rod, and to all our listeners, just in case I don't manage to get another episode out before Christmas. Last time we were discussing the Black Friday sales and all the things that were on offer, particularly from Severin. Did you get everything that you wanted to get?
I got everything that I really felt like I could afford.
Well, that's true. That's not the same thing, is it?
No, it's not. I did feel like, you know, I had to get Four Flies on Grey Velvet because that's the the big daddy of those various sales, and there were a number of other things from. What was it? Now I can't. Oh, that's terrible. Now I can't remember. Part of this is that I try to push this stuff out of my brain until it shows up in the mailbox so I can be happily surprised. I'm like, oh, yeah, that. It's impossible to forget the Four Flies thing. But the really exciting thing, I think, was the unexpected announcement that Vinegar Syndrome was putting out Santo versus Dr. Death.
Yes, I thought of you when I saw that.
Oh, yeah, that's the only Santo movie that we've ever covered on the... on the Nashy cast, mainly because so many Paul Nashy supporting actors show up in it, including Helga Linnea and a few others, and it's a pretty impressive film. It's from the Santo's period where his movies were very much influenced by the Eurospy genre. Yeah. So there were a number of years there where Santo films, those glorious luchador films from Mexico. Were essentially, James Bond ripoffs in the best way you can imagine. Yeah. So, for those curious, Santo versus Dr. Death is a good jumping on point for those of you who want to see your luchador in turtleneck sweaters. So,
yes, I'm sure that can't be the only Santo film. It seems like if you're going to do one, you may as well do loads. So I would imagine they've probably got some more in the pipeline.
I would hope so, but it's hard to know. I know that, is it Indicator? Indicator is about to bring out in January.
Yes.
The first two.
Like earlier films.
Yeah, the very first two Santo films from the 50s. And, you know, don't get me wrong, those are well worth seeing, and I cannot wait to get my hands on those Blu-rays. But the really good, juicy, you know, long-lasting, flavorful Santo stuff really kicked into high gear in the 60s. And once they kind of got a handle on how they were going to handle him as essentially a cinema superhero. And I think it's, you know, because I think, if memory serves, I think I've seen, like, that first El Santo film from way back, and it's almost as if they didn't really know how to handle him or what to do with him, because he's almost like a supporting character in his own movie where he essentially, you know, he's in the background until crap starts to go down, and then they call him in to, like, you know, rough up all the
bad
guys
in the background, wrap up the plot. The background fighting some guys in a ring.
Well, I mean, I don't even remember that's what's terrible is I it's been so long since I saw a terrible dupey version of those first couple of Santo films long ago. I can't even remember if we got, you know, because there's a wonderful rhythm that those films got into, all the luchador films, where, you know, you have, you know, all the stuff that was going on with their regular life, which means we got to see them in the ring, you know, in their various wrestling bouts. And then you had the insane plot that was actually driving what people came to the cinema to see. If you get lucky, both halves of a Santo film can be a joy, and a lot of it just depends on, you know, how dynamically the ring stuff was shot by the director. You know, how inventive did they get with their camera work? How much time? Maybe that's just down to how much time they had to film the stuff. Well, did they just set one up and shoot it, or what? You know.
This is a good excuse to plug my other podcast, Second Features, because about a year ago we did do a Santo episode. We did the sexy Santo film.
Oh, yeah.
The Vampire and the Sex, is it called?
Mm-hmm.
So we covered that with Dr. Dolores Tierney, who's actually Professor Dolores Tierney now, from the University of Sussex, who's written a lot about Mexican cinema. So, we had a pretty good dive into what Santo films are all about. So I'm intrigued. I've only seen that one, so I definitely need to check out some more. But they, of course, were an influence, just to bring things back to Italy, when we get to the Fumetti films, which we will eventually. There are some in there that are directly influenced by the Santo kind of luchador films, particularly something like what's it called, Super Argo versus Diabolicus, I think it is, where Super Argo is like a masked wrestler, basically, who's also an invincible hero. And, you know, so there was definitely an influence there. And I think, is it three Supermen, I think, is very much like a luchador movie. But all of these things, they all join up together eventually. But yeah, they are fun, and it's interesting to see Santo films getting more of a English-friendly releases at last.
Yeah.
The Severin, obviously, the thing that's connected for us is that they were putting out The Blood on Méliès Moon and The Little Wizards of Oz, I think, is it called, by Luigi Cozzi, so a couple of his most recent movies. So I'm excited to get that, and we can talk about that, and especially because of the documentary, which I think will be good to see at last. But so coming round to this week, so we're talking about Hercules and the Adventures of Hercules 2, and we were bemoaning in the last episode the fact that the original Steve Reeves Hercules films are not on Blu-ray yet, and it does seem funny that those are not, but these are. Which, I don't know, are they on Blu-ray in the States? I know over here they were released in there's a triple disc set by 101 Films, which actually Luigi Cozzi's name is not anywhere on the box. It's advertised as the Lou Ferrigno collection.
Oh,
because
really?
Because it's got the two Hercules films and then Sinbad of the Seven Seas.
Oh, that's a weird film. I know way too much about that film.
Is also yeah, which Cutsy was also involved with.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so it's a triple bill Lou Ferrigno collection on Blu-ray. And they're not, I mean, it's just basically a pretty straightforward transfer. It's not like any kind of major restoration, and there's almost zero bonus features. But still, we have these on Blu-ray before we have this, the world-changing original Hercules films, which seems a shame. But
that is weird. But it's even stranger that the sadly now out of print Shout Factory Blu-rays of the two Cozzi Hercules films.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're both just recently out of print, just in the past few months.
Okay.
There's some really nice extras on both of them, to be honest with you. The centerpiece of which revolves around some pretty juicy interviews with Luigi himself.
Shame they didn't get those on this set then either, because this has just got the trailers and that's it.
Well, it's on the first film, there's an interview with Luigi, and also they talk with the film's set designer, Antonelli Jalin. I'm obviously mispronouncing his name, but I'm impressed by his work, of course. But the both of those discs are now out of print. I don't know that they're necessarily fetching huge amounts of money on the secondary market as yet, but I would assume that would make these releases the best in the world, considering that they have extras and they look fantastic. I mean, they really do look fantastic. And here's the real question. Okay, there's a series of questions I'm going to go through them like this. What are your feelings about the peplum genre in general, Adrian?
I'm a fan. I mean, there's a lot that I haven't seen,
mm-hmm.
but I have certainly enjoyed all the ones I have seen. And I mean, as I've mentioned last time, you know, I wrote about peplum films in my PhD thesis, and
right.
that was for me, that was kind of exploring new territory. I didn't know much about them before I started that, so I was reading a lot of stuff, and I watched quite a number of the films at the time, and I really enjoyed it. I think it's great fun, and it just surprises me how sort of commercially neglected they are these days. And I guess that with this film, these films come under the banner of neo-peplum, I guess.
Yeah.
The sort of resurgence of peplum in the 80s. Although Luigi Cozzi was furious that critics called this a peplum film and that he was trying to revive the peplum genre, because he said that he wasn't. It's more going for a Ray Harryhausen vibe with this film.
Yeah,
to revive the peplum thing.
I can understand why he reacts that way, but at the same time,
I mean, it is, isn't it?
It's a Hercules movie. I mean, what are we supposed to say? Come on, cut us a little slack here. It's pretty obvious.
Yeah. So, I mean, for you, I'm guessing you've had more sort of growing up with peplum films. They play on American television a lot, didn't they?
Not as much as you might think.
Oh, okay.
I did. Don't get me wrong. There were the occasional sightings of a Hercules movie of one type or another on Saturday or Sunday afternoon, things of that nature. But they were kind of I have no firm memories of which ones I saw. None of them made enough of a lasting impression to actually be something that years later, when I'm actually going through them as an adult, I get a flash of recognition from or anything like that. So what I end up with is just having a kind of affection for the genre as a kid, and that being able to be built upon as an adult when I go back and I start actually paying attention to them and really kind of, you know, digging into them. And so that's why I don't think the 80s were the right time for an attempt to bring this kind of movie back to the big screen, no matter what they thought was happening. I mean, don't get me wrong, we all understand that, you know, the massive success of Conan the Barbarian was, you know, something that, you know, immediately put dollar signs in low-budget producers' eyes. But that film brought to the table something that I think that low budget producers really couldn't match, which wouldn't be that much of a shock. Which is just, you know, the spectacle that could be put on display. I mean, you know, we're not talking Ben Hur style stuff here, but we are talking about a film on the first Conan film is unapologetically R-rated and willing to actually, yeah, you know, dig hard into the pulp nature of the stories that are being told. And although one could say that Italian producers didn't necessarily ever shy away from that, being, you know, hardcore, as the, you know, as the youngins say, from what I'm told.
Do they?
Boy, I hope not. Anyway, the thing about this is that in general, if you're looking back at the films made in the late 50s, early 60s, that short cycle of sword and sandal films that actually did get popular over here in the States for a little while, what you're mostly paying attention to is the fact that those played primarily to kiddie matinee audiences.
Yeah.
So you know, while Conan the Barbarian by John Milius may be like the grown-up version of this kind of thing, you got to remember R-rated films are, you know, you've got a hurdle to get over to make a whole lot of money, and so you don't necessarily want to go R-rated. You want to go slightly softer than that, and at the time, slightly softer meant PG, and PG meant there were certain things you could do and there were certain things you couldn't do. And so adhering to the kind of, I hate to use this phrase, but slightly more family friendly kind of approach was probably going to be the best way to go. And in that respect, it's very easy to see why Luigi Cozzi might think, hey, you know, the best way to go here is Ray Harryhausen, because Harryhausen's films, yeah, were always, you know, they were always family friendly. But they were, you know, they were incredibly fun. They were adventures. They were exciting. And if he could, yeah, just find a way to mimic, something like the Sinbad movies or Clash of the Titans or anything like that, then, you know, surely large amounts of money would flow into his pockets.
Mm.
But something happened along the way there, I think.
Although I think the first Hercules films was quite financially successful for Canon, so I mean,
the first one was in terms a huge of being success.
In terms of being PG, I mean, this, with this film, I described, I was watching this, my wife watched some of it with me, and we both had a good laugh, and they're saying it's like a film written by a 7-year old.
Uh-huh.
You know how you get kids telling you stories and they're just making it up as they go along, and then this happened and then this happened and then he went there and then he did this, and it doesn't really make any sense.
Correct.
And so it's like it's written like a 7-year-old, but it's clearly directed by a 13-year-old boy, because although it is a PG, it's about as much female, well, and male skin on display as you can get away with in a PG.
yes, exactly.
And some of the costumes that the women are wearing are just absolutely hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
Sybil Danning, obviously. But even he meets this witch or sorceress called Cersei. And the costume she's got on, honestly, I was just laughing every time. the costume she's wearing is pretty funny stuff. So Canon. I'm assuming everybody knows pretty much who Canon was. But are you able to sort of briefly summarize the significance of Canon, or why it's kind of interesting that this was a Canon film?
Oh, my Lord. The significance of Canon is far too large. I mean, we would need an entire podcast just to discuss, yes, that. But I will briefly say,
well,
that
I believe there are some.
There are more than a few, actually, yes.
Yeah.
Canon Films was a pair of producers, Israeli producers, last names Golan and Globus, who... let's just say for people who were teenagers in the 1980s, the films that they created through Canon Group, the Canon Films, that we could rattle off a long list of titles. They kind of define action cinema in the 80s in a way that would make you think that they were I don't know, that they were, you know, major, you know, they were, you know, MGM or Paramount or Universal or just something along those lines. And yet they were this young, they were this independent upstart company that built itself and, you know, built itself up into what it became. And it's really impressive what they managed. And when you go down the long list of the films that they produced, these Hercules films kind of stand out as something slightly different, but it is amusing to learn how invested they were in it, how much they thought about. I mean, they produced lots of different kinds of films, but what they're remembered for are films that could best be summed up as stalwart silent men with guns fighting criminals. Yeah. That's, you know, that's essentially the standard for a canon film in the '80s.
Yeah. But they did a lot of family movies as well, didn't they?
Yeah, they
were
did.
Basically, but they grew so fast, and they started buying, there was a Canon cinema chain as well, wasn't there? So they were buying cinemas, and they seemed to be so dominant. And then I think they just expanded too quickly and kind of fell apart, which is a shame. But I remember like stuff like, obviously connected with this, was the He-Man film they did, Masters of the Universe.
Oh yeah,
which I remember going to see at the cinema when that was out in about 86, and was very excited to see. Didn't they also, because I mean Hercules is very much, although he mentions Ray Harryhausen as an influence, for me it feels like I'm watching the Christopher Reeve Superman movies. Mm-hmm. There's a very clear influence, I think. And didn't Canon end up doing Superman 4?
Yes.
I think that was
Yes,
Canon,
indeed they did. It's as if someone dared them to prove that Superman 3 could be the least, could go from being the worst Superman movie to something that was actually slightly better than the one that they produced.
Superman 3, it was always my favorite one of the films.
But it has, I mean,
because I was too young. I was too young, perhaps.
But there's absolutely no way to not to watch Superman 4, The Quest for Peace, and know that things have gone seriously off the rails. And
So Canon, obviously very significant and really fascinating story behind Canon. And there's documentaries about them, and there are books about them, and all sorts. But so Luigi Cozzi managed to, I think he wrote the script. And Canon were all, you know, all for it, and helped him to get Lou Ferrigno, who was his first choice for the film. And he's also teamed back up again with, what was his name? We talked about him last time. Armando Valcarada, was it?
Who
did all the special effects.
Oh, yeah.
Was it Val? Who did all the special effects for Armando Valcarada. We talked about him because he did the amazing special effects for Godzilla, and but obviously he did Star Crash as well. And here, this is very much in the Star Crash mode. We've got stop motion going on, and most of the film is set in space for some reason. There's a lot of space stuff going on in this movie.
Well, it was nice to actually have those interviews with Luigi Cozzi explaining that for him, a lot of his inspiration for the writing of this film and the look of it and what he did with it were essentially the Ray Harryhausen films and the incredibly successful Superman film from 78. Which, you know, once you've seen the film, it's like not that hard to pick up on the various things that he's, I'm going to use the word borrowed.
Yeah, even the music in this film sounds like Superman.
Yeah.
The music was by...
Oh, it was by Pino DiNaggio.
Pino DiNaggio, yeah.
Yeah.
And then they just used exactly the same score for the second film. Didn't write any new music. Just used it all again.
Well, I have to say, in this respect, I mean, the score is good enough that I think reusing it in the sequel's probably your smartest move,
Oh, no, it's very good. I'll be putting some of it in here. In fact, let's do it now. Here's the theme.
Thank you.
Yeah, the score is great, but it's very Superman. Uh-huh. It's very John Williams. And shall we mention some of the cast? We've got, I think we've got a brief cameo, I think it's only in one scene, from Brad Harris, which makes an interesting connection considering Kotze is saying, I'm not bringing the peplum back.
And yet,
then he brings Brad Harris in.
You've cast Brad Harris, yes.
Yeah.
And it's like,
what do you remember Brad Harris? What do you remember Brad Harris from?
Oh, good Lord. Brad Harris? Roughly 7 billion different movies?
Yeah. For me, it's his film Samson, because that was one of the ones I wrote about.
Okay.
So I've got an original press book, a UK press book of Samson. It's got Brad Harris written across the front. And Samson is really fun. That one has got... why is my brain not working? Serge Gainsbourg is in that one.
Oh,
as
really?
One of the bad guys. Yeah, he gets eaten by crocodiles.
Well, see, I always flash on the Commissar X films, because he was Captain Tom Roland in those films, and there were like four, at least maybe even five of those. So I know him from those. He was in the Three Fantastic Supermen as well.
Oh, there you go, yes.
Yeah. You know, you start getting into a lot of these films. I mean, Samson, I understand, and, you know, he was in a lot. Like I say, he was in a number of peplums, including, like, Goliath Against the Giants, which is one of those that constantly turns up on, you know, cheap DVD packs of sword and sandal films, no matter what you do, somehow or another. The sight of him, you know, in a loincloth wielding a sword is not a shock, even though he made lots of other kinds of films. Like I say, I flash on the Commissar X films, which are, you know, essentially kind of, you know, Eurospy things from the late 60s. Yeah. But the, you know, he was in spaghetti westerns and horror movies. He made a little bit of everything here and there. But the... I do think it is amusing. I hadn't heard anybody put it quite that way. If you're gonna complain that people are thinking your film is a peplum and you cast Brad Harris, it's like what did you think people are gonna say?
Yes, it's just total coincidence. There are some, of course, there are many beautiful actresses in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Should we start with Sybil Danning? I believe this is our first Sybil Danning film, but she, of course, is very well known in the world of cult movies.
Very true.
Her costumes are unbelievable. Very, very reminiscent of what she wears in Battle Beyond the Stars, I think it's fair to say.
True. I will say that at least one scene in this movie, I think I think her left nipple was attempting to escape, but
keeping it PG though.
That's right. Barely.
Are you friends with Sybil Danning on Facebook? Do you see her Facebook post?
I don't know that I am. I don't really think so.
It's well worth it. Her Facebook posts are so weird.
Who I am friends with.
I've said this before, but like you could do a whole thesis on her PhD, a PhD on her Facebook posts. Like, if there'll be something that'll happen in the news, like, I don't know, like something to do with gun control or something, and she'll like post an article. She'll post something about it all in caps with a photo of her from a movie where she's holding a gun, you know, or like, I don't know, something about the president, and then she'll say, and she'll post a picture of herself from one of her films and connect it to, but it's just so weird the way she does it. It's kind of funny, but
she is one of those people who it always seems as if they're trying to find a way to put themselves at the center of something just for the, you know, just for the attention, and you know, I understand
really funny. They are very funny. But obviously just so many films that she's been in over the years.
I know, I find her career so odd. There's so many, she was in so many things, and yet I hate to put it this way, I always forget that she's in some of the things that she was in. And in some cases, that would be easy. I mean, she has a small role in Richard Lester's The Three Musketeers. But, you know, how are you going to remember Sybil Danning considering that cast? I mean, you know.
Yes, true.
How are you going to outshine Oliver Reed, Christopher Lee? You know, come. It's Faye Dunaway. It's physically impossible. The film has Charlton Heston. You're going to have to stand out. And it's like, okay, so I don't think of her in that.
Whereas if you look at something like Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf.
That you can never forget.
Yeah, she has a much more prominent role. Or like I said, Battle Beyond the Stars, which is a really fun Star Wars knockoff. But she's been in Jolly as well, hasn't she? And just all kinds of stuff over the years.
Lots of different kinds.
Women of the SS. Oh, no, that's more recent. Famously
in Chained Heat, by the way.
Oh yeah, of course. With why can't I remember anyone's names?
Because it's the wrong type. With Linda Blair, man.
Linda Blair, thank you. Oh dear, she's in quite an early sort of Jallo film, isn't she?
Are you thinking of The Red Queen Kills Seven Times?
Yes, that's the one. Thank you for saving me there.
She was also in Eye of the Labyrinth.
Oh yeah. Yeah, so she's obviously still working, so it seems, and still just posting weird stuff on social media. But she's always welcome in a film. She brings a kind of class and seriousness. I mean, in this film it is very silly, but she's taken it very seriously.
Well, that's the only way to play a film like this. I mean, there's
if
you try to wink at the audience, it's all just going to fly out of control.
She milks it for all it's worth. A couple of other quick names to mention: Mirella D'Angelo as Circe, and Eva Robbins, who plays Daedalus. They are both in Tenebrae, so there's a connection back to Argento. Eva Robbins was a transsexual, which I read that later because I was trying to work out what was going on with Daedalus's costume, and that's when I realized why the costume looked like it did, because I thought it was a female actor playing Daedalus, but the costume was just a little bit strange, and now I realize why. It's because Eva Robbins is actually a transsexual who was in a film. There was a film called Eva Man, which is about Eva Robbins being a transsexual. But then I think she's one of the women in the house in Tenebrae.
Okay.
She might be the one that looks through the t-shirt that's got the hole in it, I think. But anyway, both in Tenebrae. There is another connection, actually. I'm rambling a bit here. There's another connection to Argento. which is when Argento was making Phenomenon, he was struggling with the special effects because there's a lot of sort of process work and superimposition and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And Luigi Cozzi came in and was like, oh, I've just done a whole load of that in Hercules. So Luigi Cozzi got the job to help do the special effects on Phenomenon, like the flies buzzing over the house and all that stuff. A lot of the sort of process stuff that's in Phenomenon was done by Cozzi on the back of what he did in Hercules.
Yeah, I knew he was involved in the technical end of things on some shots.
So it's thanks to his work on this one, because it's very much a special effects movie, this one. There's miniatures, there's explosions, there's process shots, there's animation,
and it's that kind of stuff that honestly always wins me over in this first film. This first movie, the 1983 Hercules film with Lou Ferrigno as Hercules, I have to say, I always, when I was younger, I turned my nose up at it and just ignored it. But at some point, around the DVD age, I decided, there was a double feature disc put out by MGM that was, like $15. It had both films on it, and I went, okay, let's check these out. I mean, I can have fun with these no matter what I do. And we'll talk about the second one in a minute, but the first one, it's the same feeling you get with other Luigi Cozzi films, and I'm thinking specifically of something like Star Crash, which is there's this overwhelming sense of enthusiasm about the story being told. And yes, the means with which he had to tell the story probably were not nearly sufficient, but that's okay when it's this fun, because he, first of all, Peplum films always had a tendency to be rather episodic. They were adventures, and so you were moving from obstacle to obstacle, essentially. You know, I hate to put it in these terms, but something along the lines of, you know, different pieces of a video game adventure, essentially, to the point where you're, you know, you've got a certain task you have to complete, and that leads you to the next task, which you have to complete, which leads to the next task, and on and on and on until you reach the final, you know, the final sequences of the story. And that is exactly how this movie plays out. Once you get past the origin of Hercules at the beginning, which, by the way, is super weird and has absolutely zero basis in the actual Greek mythology, which is something
barely any of the film matches any kind of mythology.
As a matter of fact, you could just record me saying that phrase and drop it randomly into this episode, just for fun, and it would be accurate no matter what we were talking about.
This is true.
But the episodic nature of it is something that actually helps with the essentially keeping it both part of the genre that you the way you expect the you know a Peplum film to be, but also helps in the production in that you don't need too much linking material. You don't need too many threads linking you from one thing to another, other than you know the overarching quest. Let's call it that. And the, you know, just a bare thread of dialogue saying, okay, you know, also now we have to go and, you know, do this. And you're set. You're ready. You're going. And it's fun that way, because I found myself, and I've always found myself with this first film, I found myself just really enjoying it. Just kind of curled up on the couch, you know, having fun with this kind of movie. And I don't use phrases like this very often, because I find that there was a long period of time where I felt phrases like this were overused, especially this phrase. But quite honestly, I will say, I will be on the record and say, man, they don't make them like this anymore. And there are a lot of reasons why that's true.
That's true.
And a lot of them are good reasons.
Because canon aren't around anymore to make them.
Well, there is that too, but even nowadays when they do occasionally, I mean, a few years ago they made a Hercules movie with The Rock, and it wasn't successful. You know,
it was quite good though. I liked it.
I still have never seen it,
it was pretty good actually.
I kind of need to, but they're not the kind of things that are going to be successful these days for whatever reason.
No. Because I do think this one is fun. We also, of course, we didn't mention Claudio Castagnelli is back. Possibly this podcast's kind of whack-a-mole actor. he's just constantly popping up. He's back here as Zeus.
Yes.
And we've also got the goddess Hera, played by another Peplum veteran, Rosanna Podesta.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Who did a bunch of those.
She did a lot. She was also in the Golden Arrow for Margheriti, too.
Oh, yes. That's why I recognize her, of course. The Golden Arrow. That's a lovely film.
Oh, and don't forget, and she was also in Hara Castle, or Virgin of Nuremberg for Margheriti as well. So,
yeah. I think you're right, though, that the sort of episodic nature of this film, but obviously, you know, and most of the Hercules films in some way, that's kind of mirrored in the actual Hercules story itself. If you look at the sort of the 12 labors of Hercules, it's basically, it is an episodic story. He goes here and does this, then he has to go and do that, then he has to go and do that.
Yeah.
And some of those labors are kind of in here, sort of. The main one being the cleaning of the stables by diverting a river.
Which is one of the labors, but I mean, it's not in the film. It's just used as something else. So.
This is an excuse to kiss a girl. Basically, but he's in there. It's in there. He also does something later on in the film. He divides the continents of Africa and Europe, I think.
Mm-hmm. Kind of creating the Rock of Gibraltar. Yeah,
yeah. By Circe making him huge so that he could push them across. And again, that's very much like Jason and the Argonauts, where they meet Neptune and he comes up out of the water and kind of pushes the rocks and all that. And that, incidentally, in that scene, we meet an African king played very by briefly. Bobby Rhodes.
Yeah.
Bobby Rhodes from Demons. And I just recently...
So strange, it was such a small role.
Yeah. Just recently, I did a public screening of Demons over at the Electric Palace in Hastings. I introduced it and had some themed trailers and then we watched the film in its 4K restoration, and it was so fun. The audience had a great time.
Oh,
I was
Demons
a bit worried.
Is a blast, yeah.
Yeah, I was worried because it's so kind of slimy and whether that would put people off, because these were ordinary members of the public coming in to see this. Nobody had seen it before. Actually, I think one person had seen it before and had a wry smile on their face before it started, but no one else had seen it before, and they just came along because the Electric Palace was celebrating its 20th anniversary. So for the whole of November, or was it October? No, the whole of October, they were screening films about cinemas. So naturally I said, hey, let's do Demons. So it was funny to sort of watch it with just the ordinary public rather than people who've been watching this stuff all their lives necessarily. And so I was expecting walkouts or complaints, or I was sort of bracing myself, but everyone loved it. They had such a good time because you just can't help but be won over by Demons because it's so silly.
It's so fun. Yeah.
But so it was fun to see Bobby Rhodes pop up in this as well. But anyway, look, we've been going for 40 minutes and we haven't attempted to summarize the plot
of
Hercules.
Yes.
From the depths of space comes the strongest man on Earth in the Super Adventure Odyssey. Hercules. The incredible Lou Ferrigno is Hercules. In a battle with unearthly creatures, Hercules, the superhuman hero, with the strength of an army. Hercules facing love and the bewitching forces of evil. Hercules, the all-new adventure. Hercules, a mythic flight of the imagination. Hercules, the legend comes alive. Incredible Lou Ferrigno is Hercules. A Golan Globus production from the Canon Group.
I've got the Luigi Cozzi book here that does kind of go through the plot. I can have a bit of a go, but I'll be honest, I didn't quite understand for the most part. There was something about a sword. So there's a kind of prologue where Sybil Danning and her dad, the evil King Minos, they kill Hercules' parents, or his adopted parents, I suppose, because he's a son of Zeus.
You've skipped the entire introduction of the gods.
Well, I know.
Film, the gods, they live on the moon.
The gods live on the moon. And it's, so it's Claudio Castagnoli and as Zeus, along with Hera and, I think, was it Athena? Uh-huh. And they're watching the affairs of man in their wigs. I don't know if it was Hercules or Hercules 2, but the credit for the wigs, the name of the company was just Sexy Wigs.
Really? I did not notice that. That's great.
Yeah, it's in the credit. I think that might be in Hercules 2.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yes, the credit was Sexy Wigs.
How appropriate. Yes.
They are wearing sexy wigs. And yeah, so they're kind of interfering and... They've got this problem about how to help man without interfering, and so they decide to create a man who's stronger than all the other men or something.
Uh-huh.
And they sort of forge Hercules out of the power of the sun, I think. There's some stuff about space.
I know this is going to sound strange to the listener, but it gets weird.
They send him down. So he's this baby, and he's given to this king and queen, who we only see asleep in bed. I don't think we ever see them doing anything else. Because then Sybil Danning and her father, they come along and they kill all the guards so that they can then kill them and Hercules, because he wants to be the king, this guy, Minos. And they, something about a sword. They want to steal some kind of magical sword. But then a servant girl manages to escape with Hercules and puts him in a boat and sends him off down a river.
Very much like Moses or, Kal-El.
Well, exactly. I was going to say, when at the other end, eventually after many adventures in his boat and strangling some snakes and surviving a waterfall,
hey,
he gets
if
found
you're a baby
by
and you can sur- and you can strangle snakes, you know something's going on.
Yeah. So he gets found by the clerk, you know, by the Kents, I should say.
yes, exactly.
To live, to grow up on their farm, and where he
somewhere
becomes,
in Kansas,
becomes,
obviously, yes.
Yeah, where he spends all day pushing a kind of millstone around, just like Conan, and magically turns into Lou Ferrigno. Now, the thing that I was confused about here is when he's sent down the river, he's a little baby.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like a baby who can't talk.
Right.
So how is he still called Hercules by these adopted parents? Like, how did they know he's called Hercules?
You have hit upon the one plot problem. This film.
That's it. Let's pack up and go home. I don't know whether he's got it. Maybe it was tattooed on his bum or something. I don't know. But like,
That would be funny.
They seem to
know.
They know he's called Hercules, but yep. I don't know how they know.
That's a fine question. I'm going to assume that the divine nature of the little one caused them to know it. Essentially somebody came down and said, hey, look, his name's Hercules. Call him that or you're going to have trouble. So,
yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned, the sacred sword, the golden sword that turns up in the third act, the sword that stops
fire. I'm really
confused by
the swords, because at the end of the film, there are two magic swords. And at first, there's one that's on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Which is funny, in the trailer for her, I can't remember if it was in the film, but in the trailer, when they're having that sword fight, that sword makes the lightsaber sound.
Oh, in the trailer it does, really?
In the trailer, it sounds like a lightsaber. I don't think it does in the actual movie.
If they put that in the movie, they might have gotten a little cease and desist letter from Lucasfilms. I don't know.
In the trailer, it sounds like a lightsaber. But then I thought the whole point of him stealing this sword so he could get all this power. And then at the end, we see him wielding. We see King Minos wielding this magical flaming sword. But then it turns out that isn't the sword. The sword that he nicked at the beginning is still just sitting in a stone, and then Hercules pulls out that sword so they can have a big sword fight.
I
was very confused about
not paying attention to the story.
The whole point of that sword at the beginning, I don't know what it was for.
Well, the sword was in place in that stone to keep that phoenix inside the volcano. Jeez.
But,
Do you not know your Luigi Cozzi mythos? I mean,
and that's another thing. They talk about a phoenix, and then we never actually get to see the phoenix, which was sort of disappointing.
No, we see a miniature volcano erupt. That's about all we get.
Yeah. You know, it's a bit like the kind of Chekhov's gun. If you show a gun in the first act, it has to go off in the third act.
Unless you don't have the money for it to go off. And
if they're
going to
talk about
a
phoenix, they're going to talk about a phoenix. They can't then not show us the phoenix. Come on. There's some stock footage I noticed in this film, and certainly in the second film as well. And I believe in the second movie, the stock footage is from George Powell's Atlantis Lost Continent.
Ah, yeah.
At the end of Hercules 2. But when Minos is attacking and taking over the kingdom, there's suddenly hundreds of extras running around doing peplum stuff. And I assumed that's also got to be stock footage.
It is.
There's no way Kotze staged that just for a little flashback.
Yeah, it definitely is.
So I think there's some stock footage in there too. But anyway, so look, he's living on the farm in Kansas, and then his dad gets attacked by a bear. And it's the most convincing man on bear fight, because obviously Hercules comes to save his father. And it's the most convincing man on bear fight I've seen since Arnold Schwarzenegger in Hercules in New York.
there's rarely been a more awe-inspiring man versus bear fight than...
Yeah. Which actually, yeah. Because they do kind of cut it together, don't they? So they've got stock footage of a bear. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it was. It was like outtakes from Gentle Ben or something.
Who knows? Oh, no. I do know where that's from. Supposedly, Kotze admitted to this in the interview. It's footage from Grizzly.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. So he cuts that in with Lou Ferrigno rolling around with a man in a bear suit on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly even the same bear suit as Hercules in New York. That would be a nice...
nice bit of cinema trivia to toss out there if that were true.
Yeah, but actually, that reminds me. Have you ever seen Pumping Iron, the documentary with Lou Ferrigno and Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yeah, it's been so years good. Since I rewatched it, but yeah.
Yeah, it's so fun. Mm-hmm. Because another shameless plug. We also covered that on Second Features, my other podcast, with an academic who'd written extensively about bodybuilding. So we talked about Pumping Iron, and so I watched it quite recently, and the whole thing, like this sort of comedy rivalry between Lou Ferrigno and Schwarzenegger, was really entertaining. And there are these shots of Lou Ferrigno in his New York gym in the 1970s working out, and it's just like the sleaziest, scuzziest dive, and all the men in the background who are pumping iron, they all look like extras from a Scorsese film. It's just so good. And then you cut to Schwarzenegger in like the sun-drenched beaches of California, and it's the sort of it's so good, the kind of contrast between the lives that the two of them led.
What I remember most from Pumping Iron is are the conversations between Schwarzenegger and Ferrigno, where Schwarzenegger is so brilliant at psyching Ferrigno out. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's really funny. But there's a lot of rivalry that's kind of played up in the film. But then by the end of the movie, they are actually just really good friends. And I think they got on very well together. So it's quite cool that they both got to play Hercules. I will say that I think Lou Ferrigno's Hercules films are better than Hercules in New York. But that isn't really hard.
Hercules in New York always felt like a movie that nobody was trying very hard on. So
yeah. No. But anyway, look, okay, I'm going to just get to the ending, trying to summarize this plot. So he meets, his parents get killed. One of them gets killed by a bear. Uh-huh. The other one gets killed by a flying robot creature sent down by Daedalus, who is working for King Minos.
Uh-huh.
And they've got these three robots that are all basically just extras from Star Crash. And what I liked about it is they obviously only had one set of these models, one each.
Probably.
And so Daedalus shows Minos these models, and it's just the actual models that we're going to see animated in a minute. They're just sitting there on a table, and they're just, you know, the right sort of scale, that these were clearly the miniatures that they were going to animate. So we get to see them as their real size next to King Minos, and then they come down to Earth. And so one of them attacks and kills his mum.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he runs off and ends up, he burns his, oh yeah, he burns, he puts his mum on a funeral pyre, and then he just turns around with the same torch and burns his house down.
Oh, I know. I was just like, love is he's got a friend, he's got a friend there going, what are you doing this
his
for?
His friends there like, yeah, what the hell? Oh, dear. And so he goes off to get his revenge and figure out what life is all about. And that's where he meets Brad Harris as King Orgulus, who's running a contest very similar, I thought, to it's sort of Robin Hood-esque, Or even, we saw it, didn't we, in The Golden Arrow, where there's a contest and whoever gets to be the strongest or the best gets to be the champion. They don't get to win the daughter of the king, although he basically does in the end.
Yeah.
But he's looking for a champion to go on a quest and do a thing. And Hercules falls in love with his daughter, Cassiopeia, who then, the whole plot, if there is a plot, is basically Hercules on a quest to find Cassiopeia because she's been kidnapped by King Minos, I think.
Yep.
So he can sacrifice her to the volcano. And Hercules has to go on a series of adventures, fight more robots, meet more sexy ladies.
Let's go ahead and address the robot in the room. before we dance along and past this, the biggest hurdle that almost anyone, no matter how forgiving they are of films of this type, is going to have are the stop motion robot creatures that Hercules fights along the way. And it's understandable, and of course, it's exactly they're in the movie exactly for the same reason that anybody with any knowledge of Luisi Cozzi would immediately surmise, which is that what he wanted, of course, was to include, you know, Ray Harryhausen style stop motion monsters in his film because that would make the movie wonderful. But of course, time and money are against him. And so he opts for the robotic things that were, you know, very much what were used in Star Crash, because they can look herky jerky and get away with it because they're robotic, and therefore, as he put it, you know, take roughly 3 months as opposed to 30 years. So there was an amused way in which he phrased it. He says, if we found a way to do them in real Harryhausen style, we'd still be waiting for the special effects right now. So they
don't even last very long. Like Daedalus talks about how these robots are, you know, gonna beat Hercules and they're super strong and all this. And the fights themselves they're over very quickly. It's like a giant robot versus Hercules with a piece of wood. And Hercules wins every time.
Yeah, Hercules just feeds a stump post to the murderous machine god, and it dies. So yes.
Yeah. So it's all over very quickly, and then eventually gets to he goes into hell at one point with Circe. He has to go because every time he meets somebody and they say, "Oh yeah, I can help you, but first of all, you've got to help me get this thing," and then he'll do that, and then they'll say, "No, you've got to help me get this thing." So. He ends up having to help Circe to get some kind of magic egg, and she has to go to hell to get this egg or something. I forget exactly how that worked. It actually reminded me a bit, one of the things I didn't like about The Mandalorian, although I thought The Mandalorian was really good, the Star Wars show, but it was very much a, okay, I'll help you, but first you've got to help me do this thing kind of show. So each episode he's having to help people do a thing so that he can get to the next point in his journey. And it's kind of very episodic, and it sort of reminded me like that a little bit. It's like Hercules just trying to get to save Cassiopeia, but first of all he's got to do somebody's decorating. Then the next person wants him to go down the shops and get a packet of bags, and then the next person, you know, he's like, oh, can he just go and do the thing?
I can really use some chocolate.
Yeah, exactly. So eventually, anyway, so Circe. Oh, this also reminded me. The film reminds me a lot of Yore. Because, you know, he misses Cassiopeia. She's gone for most of the film because she's been kidnapped, and in the meantime he hooks up with Circe, and Circe is in love with him too. But if you're a witch and you fall in love with a man, you lose your witchy powers or something. So there's a bit of a frisson between the two of them, but then she dies, and her dying words are like, now you can save Cassiopeia and all this. And that reminded me of Yore, when there's that awkward moment in Yore where there's a bit of a threesome happening, and Yore's girlfriend is really jealous of the other girl, and then the other girl dies, and then, you know, all of that. It just sort of reminded me of that quite a bit. Also, some of the monster fights remind me of Yore, especially in Hercules 2, where he's fighting, like, swamp men and stuff like that.
True. Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right.
Yeah. So anyway, so he finds Cassiopeia, who has been kind of drugged into thinking that it's fine to be thrown into a volcano. And she's dressed in, she's basically just got seashells stuck to cover her modesty.
Yes.
And a very skimpy kind of fringed outfit and very little else on underneath, which I guess if you're going to be that close to all that molten lava, you wouldn't want to have too many layers.
I guess. It's going to be hot there, surely.
So it sort of makes sense. So Hercules has to fight King Minos in the volcano, and that's where the two swords come in and the lack of a phoenix. As you can tell, I'm still bitter about that. But so anyway, I don't know, we've pretty much given it all away. I don't want to sound like I'm just MST3K-ing this film, because I really enjoyed it, and it would be easy to just rip into it.
Oh yeah.
As we've kind of accidentally proved. But on the plus, you know, there's lots of positives. You know, Lou Ferrigno is good, all the people are really good. The action is kind of, you know, it's very fast paced. There's barely a dull moment, really.
Oh no, and there's so many. I mean, we haven't even talked about one of my favorite moments, which is when he attaches the rock to the chariot, throws the rock so that it propels the chariot.
Yeah, so he can fly. He's only got, what made me laugh with that one, and I do sound like I'm taking the mic, but yeah, so he's got to use this flying chariot, but the flying horses have gone missing, so he uses a rock instead.
Yep.
And like throws it.
It's like Mjolnir. It's like Thor throwing the hammer, you know.
But he's only got to get from one island to the next island. But instead he flies halfway around the galaxy.
I was about to say, we're out of outer space at a certain point.
The chariot just disappears into space. I'm like, where are they going? It's only just down the road. So that made me laugh as well. But it's so fun. Kotsi, his heart is in the right place, and that's what I think I love about his films.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that he's not doing this just to make a quick buck. Like, he's doing this because he loves the fantasy genre.
Mm-hmm.
And I think somewhere in the book they call these films, is it called Fantasta Mitologico? So it's this sort of combination of mythology with fantasy, and then all the kind of sci-fi stuff that you've got going on as well.
Mm-hmm.
With this sort of very, very spacey special effects. So Hercules 2, let's quickly talk about that, because I don't want to spend too much longer.
From a world beyond imagination, the man with supernatural strength, Hercules, returns to save humanity from the destructive forces of evil. Sorcerers and magicians join forces in the ultimate master plan to rule the earth.
Lord of Fire!
Hercules must summon untapped strength in an attempt to save mankind. Monsters of every description battle for the honor of killing Hercules. The goddess Aphrodite is captured by an evil magician in an effort to trap Hercules.
I will find you!
The heavens become a battlefield when Hercules meets his match. The incredible Lou Ferrigno in the all-new Hercules 2. The Adventures of Hercules. The legend is back.
I don't want to try and go through that one in as much detail.
Well, it's easier to go through, and luckily now with those interviews on the Shout Factory Blu-rays, I now understand why the second film is such a pale shade.
Is what it is. Yeah. Although I still found it very entertaining. I got up really early in the morning to watch it before anyone else in my family was awake, so I was kind of slightly half asleep, but it held my attention. I did not fall back to sleep at any point. So the film started out because Canon asked Bruno Mattei to make a peplum film, basically, called The Seven Magnificent Gladiators.
Yes.
Which also starred Lou Ferrigno, I keep trying to say it like the Italians would, but I think he pronounced it Ferrigno, didn't he?
Uh-huh.
Lou Ferrigno. So, yeah, so the seven Magnificent Gladiators, they were not happy with how that was going. So they tried to fire Bruno Mattei. And then they asked Cozzi to rewrite it and shoot some new scenes and basically finish it. And so he did. And he wrote some stuff. And then they said, actually, no, we're just going to release the seven Magnificent Gladiators anyway. So he then just took what he'd written and wrote a completely new story around what he'd written, and that became Hercules 2.
Yeah, well, the funny thing from the Luigi Cozzi interviews on the Blu-ray is that he points out that what they had shot the Seven Magnificent Gladiators, and Gullin and Globus, you know, saw it and were like, "Oh my God, this is terrible! If we release this." Because they were already like wanting to do a Hercules film with Ferrigno. If we release this thing, the Hercules film, they'll laugh us off the screen. So they held it back, and with the idea that there's got to be a way to fix this. So they did the Hercules movie, and it was successful enough. They'd already held Seven Magnificent Gladiators back. And so, the idea of shooting some stuff to insert into Seven Magnificent Gladiators so that it wouldn't suck so much. And by the way, honestly, folks, Seven Magnificent Gladiators is terrible, terrible.
It makes you wonder whether they had actually seen a Bruno Mattei film before they hired him.
Oh, good question. I don't know, because he was the wrong man for the job, and yeah. If you want it done in a boring fashion, then you're fairly safe with Mattei. But the thing is, the contracts that they had for Ferrigno paid him, I forget what astronomical sum it was, to shoot Hercules, to shoot each one of the movies, right? And they didn't want to pay him to shoot. So the idea was they talked Ferrigno into taking only like something like $10,000 to just shoot a few scenes to insert into Seven Magnificent Gladiators, and Ferrigno agreed to that. And that's what they did. But then once they'd shot that in only like 2 weeks, Gullin and Globus got the idea that, hey, wait a minute, if we gave you just another, you know, that same amount of money you just had to do this in another 2 weeks, we could get a whole nother Hercules movie out of this. And we don't tell Ferrigno about it. We just do it because you've already got this Ferrigno stuff. And so that's what they did.
So he didn't know that he was making another Hercules film.
Correct. At first, they were being honest with him that they were going to insert the stuff that they were shooting for, the stuff that you see him doing in the second Hercules film was going to be inserted into Seven Magnificent Gladiators. But along the way, they suddenly realized, hey, we could get a whole other Hercules film out of this because this one just made a lot of money, and if we can put out another one, we can make some more money. So they did not tell Ferrigno, because then it would cost too much to have it, you know, to have him do an entire new Hercules film. So they just took what they'd shot in those 2 weeks, and then had Luigi Cozzi, who, you know, is like rolling his eyes the whole time, going, "Oh my God," construct another entire, like, more, you know, 40 plus minutes of film to make another Hercules film. So, in other words, all of the stuff you see Ferrigno doing, he thought he was shooting, was to be inserted into Seven Magnificent Gladiators. But what ended up happening was they concocted a whole second Hercules movie out of it and decided, we're not even going to try to save Seven Magnificent Gladiators. We'll just hold off on putting that out until we can make some money off these Hercules flicks. And so the reason the second Hercules film, to my mind, kind of sucks is... It is exactly that thing that you always fear when you're watching some kind of half-baked Euro trash thing from the 70s or 80s, which is you're not positive everybody had a script, because quite honestly, they really didn't. Yeah. This was all being done later on. So that's why you have King Minos, being resurrected. So you get William Berger popping up as King Minos again.
Dracula, Prince of Darkness style as well. Exactly. I thought that was quite good.
It's like
the guy being hung upside down over him and then blood trickling down. That was quite cool.
Exactly. And it's like there's so many times within these movies where you can spot exactly the reference, exactly where he's getting his inspiration, quote unquote, inspiration from. And in this case, it's completely forgivable in my opinion because he's having to do this as quickly as he can because he's suddenly got to make an entire film.
I mean, it works, though, because he does bring back Zeus. So we've got Claudio Castagnoli again as Zeus. Mm-hmm. Daedalus is back helping Minos again. He's got a different... So he's got Hera and Athena helping him again, Zeus, but they're played by different people. But I just noticed that Athena this time is played by Lou Ferrigno's wife.
Correct.
So there must have been a point where they knew they were making Hercules too, because his wife is playing one of the gods again.
I think it could have been easy enough to just convince everybody that hey, no, this is how we're going to fix Seven Magnificent Gladiators.
Yeah. I don't know, but it's fun again. Is the quest this time, he's got to find the seven thunderbolts of Zeus,
which is madness,
and they're all hidden inside monsters or something,
as best we can tell. Sometimes they're inside a rock.
Yes. Now, one thing I liked, there's a couple of fun location spotting things in this movie. So, I was watching. They go to a place where there's a cave, and the entrance to the cave is a big mouth. And if you know your cult film, which most of you do, I'm sure, then that will look very familiar. And I was watching, and I suddenly realized that it's the gardens from the Christopher Lee. Oh, come on. What is wrong with my brain today? Is it Castle of the Living Dead?
Oh, yeah.
Christopher Lee and Donald Sutherland.
Well, not only that, it's also it was used in a couple of different movies. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's the one I recognize it from. So that was quite fun to see that pop up. And also, at the there's a moment near the end of the film where Hercules goes to a temple. And it's the same Roman ruins that we just saw in the Heroine Busters.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
There's like a big motorbike chase and a big fight around the temple ruins. And here it's some kind of ancient temple. So, I mean, both of the films do, we haven't really mentioned that, but they make great use of Italy's locations. There's beaches, there's caves, some really cool caves.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a few scenes with Roman ruins and stuff like that. Like, he makes great use of what was available to him. And also, there's a lot of studio work in De Paola Studios in Rome. But yeah, some great use of locations. But those were a couple of things that I spotted in Hercules 2 that I quite enjoyed. He makes friends with a new bunch of women this time. It's Cassiopeia is no longer in the picture. The main hero this time is Urania. And she's trying to stop the evil king from... sacrificing virgins, I think they say they're virgins, sacrificing the local women to some kind of big electric monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and of course, it's very easy to spot what that was from. That is, they're literally rotoscoping off the screen of Forbidden Planet, the id monster from Forbidden Planet.
Yes.
It's he admits in the interviews, yeah, that's exactly what we did.
Now, speaking of... Okay, I'm not going to go through the whole plot, but basically he finds all these seven thunderbolts in different places. There's some quite fun stuff along the way.
There's some fun stuff really along the way, but it's less coherent this time around, that's for sure.
Which is really, you know, you wouldn't think possible. but then he has... At the end, there's a fight at the end, which again uses rotoscoping. And I read that they... So he's fighting King Minos again. Mm-hmm.
Once again, it's a sword battle.
Yeah, but then it turns into kind of an animated thing.
Yes.
And then King Minos turns into a dinosaur.
And then there's King Kong fighting a T-Rex.
Yeah, and because apparently that is rotoscoped from King Kong.
Exactly.
That whole fight. But I was like, watching this and thinking, why is King Minos just turned into a dinosaur for no reason?
Because he had to reach 80 minutes. That's why.
Yeah.
And he no longer had Lou Ferrigno because he had to do something. Yeah. So
he's got to animate, yeah.
So they literally just rotoscoped the fight sequence at the end of the first movie and made it the end of the second movie and added in all this crazy stuff like King Kong. to make it just different enough.
But it's really fun. Honestly, I was never bored watching these movies. And partly because I'm just trying to think, what? Who? Where? How? Like, trying to keep hold of the plot keeps your attention, I think, for one thing. Obviously, you know, speaking purely from the male gaze perspective, the women are all beautiful again in this film, just as they are in the first film. The action is exciting. The special effects are very ambitious, and you can tell he didn't have a lot of time or money.
Yeah,
I think it said in the book that they used about 20 different effects houses around Europe for this movie. And some of it was done... This is 1985, and some of it was done on video. He's done some of the like superimposition stuff on video and then had that transfer to film. And you can really tell...
Mm-hmm.
Those bits do not look great.
No.
Because the film is shot on 35 and it looks beautiful in moments, but then you get to some of the composite shots that were done on like pneumatic tape or something.
Oh, and they look
and
terrible.
They put back and they're so degraded and grainy, but not in a good way. They don't look good.
And in
which
a film,
is a shame.
And in a film where the rest of it, especially in a nice remastered version, the bits actually shot, you know, on locations and things like that, they look gorgeous, man. They're razor sharp and just beautifully photographed. And then
and the lighting is very reminiscent, and presumably deliberately, of Barber's Hercules as well, with the sort of colored gels and all of that. So it looks great, but then unfortunately those video effects, they may have been a cheaper solution at the time, but they have aged badly, which is a pity.
Well, I mean, at the time, it's really the only way he could get the film finished. And, you know, he's concocting a movie he didn't intend to make out of material he shot for a different film to fix someone else's film on a budget that is a sheer fraction of what he had for the previous movie. And so you can kind of be amazed that he finished it at all, that there's a movie in front of you that you can watch right now, that it exists, is a minor cinema miracle.
Luigi Cozzi is a problem solver.
To be blunt, clearly that is what he has been.
Because this is around the same time when he also had to go in and help out on Vampire in Venice, wasn't it, I think?
Oh yeah, so, and I need to find out more about what he did on Vampire in Venice.
I'm not sure if he can even remember, but I know he was there, even only for a few days. Like five different people directed that film.
I know it's a hodgepodge. Yeah, it's a surprise that movie exists the way it exists at all too.
If you've got a problem, you call Luigi Cozzi and he'll solve it for you.
Mainly because he's seen so damn many movies that he can just piece something together.
Exactly. And because he's got this just unabashed love for sci-fi and fantasy. I mean, he started Italy's first kind of genre, sci-fi genre magazine back in the 60s, and he's just always loved that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really comes through here, and I really like that about it, despite the fact that I had no real clue what was going on most of the time.
Especially not in the second one. Man, this second one.
But it is good. I still enjoyed it. I still gave it 3 stars, I think. they're both very entertaining, and that's all you want, really, I think, in these kind of films. But
I have to say, anyway, I'm glad to have rewatched these. But this reaffirms my belief that I absolutely love the first one. I do. I think it's wonderful. I think it's a good example of the genre, regardless of the time period in which it was produced. And I have always wondered why the second one is such a hodgepodge. And now that I know, I kind of have a little bit more respect for it, but I still don't, it's like, I don't want to go back and revisit it. But the first one, I can imagine rewatching it, you know, 2 or 3 times a year. It's just a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good fun. Well, okay, let's leave it there, Rod. I think you and I can both put our shirts back on now. And
got to go get the oil off of me.
It's getting chilly in here, but it's been really good to do this. We've got one more Luigi Cozzi film to go in our little season here, which is going to be The Black Cat. So whether or not we get to do that before Christmas, I'm not sure, but we'll give it a good try.
I was about to say, looking at my schedule, I don't know, but
yeah, Probably not. But anyway, we'll get to it and then hopefully get to the man himself finally after all this time. So thank you everybody for listening. Do get in touch with us via social media. All the links are in the show notes. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram. They're the main places, or email. And then we're also on there as well. You can buy us a coffee. There is a link in the show notes if you'd like to support the podcast. And what else? I think that's probably about all I've got, I think. Anything you want to plug, Rod, before we go, that you've got coming up? Podcast episodes or anything happening?
We've got our annual Christmas horror or holiday horror episode coming out this
good.
Year.
What are you doing? What are you doing this year, or is it a secret?
We're doing the little British film from I think 2008 or 2009 called The Children. Have you ever seen it?
Oh, okay. No, I haven't. I know it. I haven't seen it. Is that a Christmas film?
It is. It is more along the lines of a New Year's film, but it takes place kind of in that sweet spot. Yeah, it's a 2008 film. Oh, in that sweet spot of, you know, kind of during Christmas vacation. But right. I'll just say that it's essentially kind of an evil children movie. So,
that's a good subgenre.
Mm-hmm. Good little movie. Good little. It's a British film. It's good. It's a good little flick. Mm. Recommended. Oh, well,
we do occasionally manage to get some out over here. okay. Well, we'll look forward to that. And thank you everybody. Until next time. Bye for now.
Bye everyone. Thank you for listening.
Catching stone, Newton, how can I survived what's going on. Big steal a borrow. Somehow I've got to make it till tomorrow. Can't depend on no one else. Coming up the hard way, I've got to save myself. Must be hurt to me. Must be Hercules. Talk about me if you please. I must be Hercules.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.